Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the legal history of the Second Amendment, which has been interpreted by the NRA and gun rights activists to bestow constitutional rights on the unrestricted ownership and use of guns in America. Professor of History and Chair of Education at New York University, Jonathan Zimmerman, joins us to discuss his article in the Christian Science Monitor, Sandy Hook, The NRA's Gun Rights Are a Fabrication of Modern Times. Then we will speak with Michael Lind, who has an article at Salon.com, Guns Have Never Saved Us. We will further discuss how gun advocates have misread the Second Amendment and examine the real historical record that shatters the cherished myth America won its freedom from the Redcoats because of individual gun ownership and that an armed citizenry protects our liberties from government tyranny. Then finally, we'll look into the findings of a report by an independent panel who investigated the Benghazi incident that Fox News and the Republicans have been trying to blow up into a major foreign policy issue. The author of America's Other Army, the U.S. Foreign Service and 21st Century Diplomacy, and former Financial Times correspondent Nicholas Kralev joins us. He has traveled the world with four U.S. Secretaries of State, Hillary Clinton, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Madeleine Albright. Joining us now is Jonathan Zimmerman, who's a professor of education and history and director of the History of Education Program at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. He also holds an appointment in the Department of History at NYU's Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. A former Peace Corps volunteer and high school teacher, Zimmerman is the author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. He has an article at the Christian Science Monitor, Sandy Hook Massacre, the NRA's Gun Rights Are a Fabrication of Modern Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Zimmerman.
Thanks for having me.
And it's extraordinary to think that a very simple amendment to the Constitution that was passed by Congress and ratified by the states and authenticated by Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of State, reads as follows: a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. How has that become so misinterpreted in America?
Well, I think the larger historical point is that really up until the 1970s, almost nobody thought this amendment protected individual gun rights. The reason I wrote my piece is I wanted to remind readers just how new that interpretation is. For the vast majority of our history, the assumption was that this amendment protected collective security and specifically protected the right of state militias to arm themselves. But nobody, or almost nobody, thought it protected an individual right, and indeed the court said that it didn't. It's really only in the past 3 to 4 decades that this has become part of the doctrine, and I should say it's been quite successful from the point of view of the advocates of the doctrine. So we now find millions of Americans who do believe that the amendment supports individual gun rights, but we need to remember, again, that's of incredibly recent vintage.
And what effect did the recent decision where the Supreme Court struck down a ban on handguns by the District of Columbia in 2008? There was a certain amount of outrage at that point where the predicate to the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state, seemed to have been moved to the back of it. And the following part, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, that seemed to move to the front row. Is that what happened?
Yes, no, that's exactly right. And that was really the culmination, the apotheosis of about 3 or 4 decades of legal activism by the NRA and other groups in its camp. They actually enlisted law professors to write law review articles in especially the 70s and 80s promoting this new view. And I think it's fair to say that this view and the NRA itself are the radicals here. I think it's interesting that we often now call this view conservative, but in a dictionary sense, it's actually quite radical because it is an extreme departure from the past.
So given that this was largely authored, this opinion, that where the Supreme Court struck down the ban on handguns by the District of Columbia in 2008, largely authored by Justice Scalia, joined by his four conservative colleagues, and I think I'll use your word, radical colleagues, in this case. Nevertheless, in his opinion, Justice Scalia said, like all rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited, and nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. We also recognize another important limitation on the right to keep and carry arms, prohibiting the carrying of dangerous and unusual weapons. So as I read that, I'm thinking of the Sandy Hook, and I'm thinking, well, you know, a mentally ill person, you know, not having guns in schools, and not having carrying dangerous and unusual weapons like assault rifles.
Well, see, the way I would interpret this, I'm glad you quoted that, because I think some people have misinterpreted the Heller decision, that's this D.C. decision in 2008, to be a kind of affirmation of unbridled gun rights. It actually isn't, for the reasons that you just stated. But I would say that the NRA especially has been so successful in promoting the idea of an unbridled individual gun right that we've even misinterpreted Heller. That is, we think, or lots of people think, before they read it, that it says you can have any gun and take it anywhere. It doesn't say that. But it does say that the Second Amendment implies an individual gun right, not an unlimited one. All right, but it does say that this isn't just about militias. The amendment allows individuals or guarantees a kind of individual right separate from the collective, separate from the militias. Now, look, in fairness, we should say that legal doctrine always evolves, and many of us on the left often celebrate its evolution, right? Think about, you know, legal doctrine involving race. For 200 years, we have court decisions that uphold or even celebrate things like enslavement or segregation or disenfranchisement. And we tell a story, many of us, of how, you know, through activism, through protest, through research, we develop more enlightened legal views. It is possible, okay, although I wouldn't agree with it, for somebody in the NRA to say, look, for about 200 years, we misinterpreted the Second Amendment to say it was just about militias, where really it should be about individual gun rights. I might not agree with that statement, but at least it has the virtue of honesty. The dishonest position that I will not abide by, that I will not hear and will not accept, is that for 200 years anybody could have a gun wherever they wanted until the big bad liberal state took it away. That story is a lie.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Zimmern, who's a professor of education and history and director of the History of Education program at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. He also holds an appointment in the Department of History at NYU's Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. He's a former Peace Corps volunteer and high school teacher and the author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. And he has an article at the Christian Science Monitor, Sandy Hook Massacre, The NRA's Gun Rights Are a Fabrication of Modern Times. I learned from your article, Jonathan, not just some of the history of the NRA, which was founded in 1871 as a hunting organization and backed the first major federal gun regulation, the 1934 National Firearms Act, which, of course, bans the use of machine guns. And then, but what I find extraordinary is how the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Warren Burger, reflecting on the NRA's politicking, said that the Second Amendment has been the subject of one of the greatest pieces of fraud. I repeat the word fraud on the American public by special interest groups that I have ever seen in my lifetime.
That's right. That's right. I mean, that was, you know, that was Burger's view. And let's remember that Burger was a Nixon appointee. He was a career Republican. But you know, he was speaking right on the cusp of this new interpretation, this new change, brought to us by a new NRA. As you mentioned earlier, I mean, the original NRA supported all kinds of gun legislation, both at the state level, including bans on concealed weapons, including license and permit requirements, and then the first federal laws. You know, their motto said something about firearm safety, nothing about, you know, the right to bear arms shouldn't be infringed. They were obviously gun enthusiasts, gun owners, mostly sportsmen, and what they wanted was the safe use of guns for recreation.
So obviously they have moved at quite a pace to change the laws, and there's been a blizzard of these conceal and carry laws. 44 states have passed these since 1980, this means that people can carry concealed weapons outside of their homes. But what's interesting about that, as you point out in your article, Jonathan Zimmerman, at the Christian Science Monitor Sandy Hook Massacre, the NRA's gun rights are a fabrication of modern times. You point out that a 2004 Gallup poll found that 44% of Americans believe that only law enforcement officials should have the right to carry and conceal. Another 26% that only those who have a clear need for a weapon should be able to carry and conceal, leaving only 27% supporting the NRA's position.
That's true, but also that was in 2004, and I think all of us, in fairness, should point out that the poll trends have been all towards gun rights and away from gun control. You know, the worst argument right now in favor of gun control is that the public favors it. The real problem is that the, quote, gun rights lobby has been so effective in persuading people. Look, my hat's off to them in a way. Even though I loathe their position, they have been extremely disciplined and extremely eloquent in putting it forward, and they have persuaded people. And I think that right now the best argument is not, you know, the people want gun control because all the poll literature is trending away from that. The best argument is, you know, we let the gun rights lobby win this rhetorical war, and we have to fight back now. We have to do exactly what they did, and that's what democracy is. I support what they did in that sense, putting forth their view. People who oppose that view should not pretend that they're in the majority. They're not. In a lot of ways, they're in the minority. What they need to do is get back to history, get back to organizing, and persuade people in the other direction.
So do you think, Jonathan Zimmerman, that the president can start this movement that you're talking about to reverse the power of the NRA to change the laws and to essentially reinterpret the Second Amendment? He came out today and said that he was putting Vice President Biden in charge of a intergovernment administration-wide effort to create new recommendations. He was very insistent that this was not yet another government report that would be ultimately shelved, that he wants something to really come out of this. And he went on to say, we're going to need to work on making access to mental health care at least as easy to access as access to guns. You know, I mean, everything that all of the response to Sandy Hook is you know, obviously belated, but rational, I think, on the part of people who are appalled by it. But to reinforce what you said about how effective the gun lobby has been. Yesterday was the biggest sales day in the history of the United States for guns. They're flying
that's
off
right.
the shelves.
And the
gun manufacturers are laughing all the way to the bank.
This is going to be a long struggle, and I don't blame the gun manufacturers either. I mean, you know, look, it's a legal product, right? They're trying to sell it. The problem is not in gun manufacturers, and the problem is not in Obama. The problem's not in the NRA. The problem's in us. You know, we get the democracy that we deserve. I don't think that there are any real sinners or devils in this. I think the public has to be persuaded that we have moved in the past 40 years in a radical and dangerous direction. Whether the president can persuade them of that is a very open question. I was very pleased to see that, you know, he appointed Biden to this position. He was very direct about the need to do something absolutely right now. I understand the reasons that the gun control lobby has been so disappointed with the president. I've been disappointed with him myself. But then I see all this poll literature about how many people believe in gun rights, right? And I think everyone who criticizes the president has to ask themselves, if he had come out vehemently for gun rights, either when he was running against, if he'd come out vehemently for gun control, either when he was running against McCain or against Romney, would he have been elected? I think there's a lot of strong evidence to suggest no. So it's pretty hard in this hurly-burly world of politics to cast too hard a stone at him. I think he's a vastly superior president than either of those individuals would have been. And I say that as somebody who is deeply distressed by, you know, the rise of the gun rights ideology and the ubiquity of guns in this society. It's a tough nut to crack.
But surely, Jonathan Zimmerman, one of the problems that we have with our government and the Supreme Court, its decision in Citizens United has only exacerbated this problem, is that special interests and special interest money have an inordinate effect and power in Washington. And the NRA has often been described as a very, very fearful lobby that has the Congress people quite as scared not to cross them, and that they make it clear that if you cross us, we'll run somebody against you in a primary, in the next primary, and defeat you, and we'll spend unlimited amounts of money, which incidentally come from the gun and ammunition manufacturers. They play hardball. The only person that I can see in our political world that understands this and is trying to do something about it is Mayor Bloomberg, because he's basically saying to politicians, I'll have your back. If the NRA come after you, I'll make sure you get funding from me. So maybe that's absolutely a place to start.
Look, perhaps so. You know, I mean, look, what you just said about the power of the gun lobby is true, but that goes for a million different lobbies, right? Because of, you know, the nature of money in American politics right now. This is in no way exclusive to the gun issue. It may well be that the consequences of it are more awful and morbid, right? But you could talk about 70 different issues in which a certain lobby exerts inordinate power. I mean, I do think it's ironic, although I deeply support what Bloomberg is doing and saying, for those of us who are critical of the role of big money in politics, it is, I don't want to use too strong a word, it's not hypocritical, but there is something a little bit ironic about in the same breath saying, oh God, you know, the political system is so corrupt because there's just so much, like, private money running through it, right, that's biasing everything. And then, you know, applauding Mike Bloomberg when he writes an enormous check out of his bank. You know, there's an interesting tension there. Again, I'm not criticizing him for doing so. And it may well be that given the current legal landscape involving Citizens United and everything else, that's the only way to go. It's a sad moment in a way.
Well, Jonathan Zimmerman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. I hope it was useful.
Very much so.
Okay. Have a good night.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Zimmerman, who's a professor of education and history and director of the History of Education program at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. He also holds an appointment in the Department of History at NYU's Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. He's a former Peace Corps volunteer and high school teacher and the author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. He has an article at the Christian Science Monitor, Sandy Hook Massacre, the NRA's Gun Rights Are a Fabrication of Modern Times. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking further about how gun advocates have misread the Second Amendment.
Come on back, Jesus.
Come on back, Jesus.
Come on back, Jesus. Pick up John Wayne on the way. The world's getting crazy, and it seems to get worse every day. Come on back, Jesus, and pick up John Wayne on the way.
Here and now, our choices here are broken. As children grow, they grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are rampaging disease. In our minds, we build the blocks to what we need. In our minds, we're reaching out for peace. In our hearts, we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts, a sense of master feet.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who is a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And he also has an article at Salon.com, Guns Have Never Saved Us. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
And your article at Salon, Michael, explodes the myth that's a cherished myth amongst supporters of unlimited gun rights who cite the Second Amendment as empowering citizens to arm themselves. But what you're pointing out here, that it wasn't armed citizens who won our freedom in the American Revolution, and they've never been able to protect it subsequent to the American Revolution. You mentioned here, in fact, that during the American Revolution, it was actually the French soldiers fighting on American soil and the emigrant mercenaries who were signed up for pay and land that made the difference.
Yes, that's exactly right. There is this myth that a lot of hardy citizen soldiers who just grabbed their muskets off of their mantles above their fireplaces just ran out and then sent the British redcoats packing back home. In fact, the armies on both sides were largely paid professional soldiers from many different countries, particularly Ireland and Germany, were overrepresented. And in the case of the United States winning its independence from Britain, the U.S. had professional French armies, along with the help of the French Navy at sea, side by side with George Washington and his forces. So it's simply as cherished as it is as a myth among Americans, it's just not the case that citizen militias have played the crucial role not only in the War of Independence but in any other war. In the Civil War and in the two World Wars, a draft was necessary. It wasn't the state militias played only a negligible role. And in the early 20th century, the militias were more or less absorbed into the standing federal army in the form of the National Guard and Reserve units, which kind of made nonsense of the Second Amendment constitutional provision, which, if read properly, it says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the society of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So the Second Amendment does not envision individuals having guns against all levels of government, including the local county or city sheriff and police department. The well-regulated militia is the militia of the free state, that is, of one of the constituent states of the United States. And it was written at a time contemplating possible war between, you know, the state of Massachusetts and the state of South Carolina and the federal government, something which fortunately has not been an issue since the defeat of the Confederacy in the Civil War. It's difficult to see how anyone can get from reading the Second Amendment a right of individuals to bear, you know, modern weapons of war, rather than simply an anachronistic reference to arming a state militia.
So the idea, the true story, not the cherished myth, that the individual American revolutionary took the musket off the fireplace and went out and drove the redcoats ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes. I recall that song. Now, what was really happening, was it not, that the native farmers tended to drop out, as you point out, of the Continental Army? Is that why Tom Paine wrote that famous line about the Sunshine Patriots and the summer soldiers?
Yeah. And actually, they didn't even bring their weapons. They were issued weapons, many of which were French weapons that the French were giving to the American colonists, because it was a war between France and Britain, as much as a war between the American colonists and Britain. So they took their government-issued French muskets and bayonets, and then they took them home with them, and they never returned them, along with their uniforms. So there was a real problem where the farmers with families would drop out of the military. And so by the end of the war, George Washington was quite disgusted with the citizen soldiers. And he relied heavily on the professional mercenaries who were either landless American colonists who were in it in the hope of getting land and money, or else they were immigrants from Europe, some of them veterans of other 18th century wars. And they were whipped into shape under General von Steuben, who was a Prussian immigrant general. And they were led sometimes by foreign generals like Lafayette. So it really, the American Revolution, contrary to the popular myth, really looks a lot like the cabinet wars of the 18th century, the Seven Years' Wars, where you have kind of a multinational military force, both at the level of the soldiers and at the level of the officers. There were German emigre officers commanding both British forces and the American rebel forces in some cases. So this myth of the citizen soldier, which I should add, it's a myth on the populist left, as well as of the right. You know, this idea of gun ownership being a symbol of Republican virtue, it was shared by Tom Paine, whom the NRA quotes as an opponent of gun control, for the reason that and before the French Revolution, the reactionary regimes in Europe forbade ordinary people to own weapons. That was a mark of aristocratic status. So there is a tradition in Western Europe itself, particularly in France and in Italy and in Switzerland, where there's something kind of like the gun culture in the United States on the left. It's not necessarily a reactionary thing. The pre-modern aristocrats had the exclusive right to bear arms and to hunt. And so quite logically, these smaller Republican progressives thought, well, if you have a democracy, then everyone should have the right to bear arms and also to hunt. The problem is these weapons that are being used in these mass killings, these are modern weapons of war. They're more like bazookas and landmines, you know, than they are like the sorts of rifles and shotguns that you need to hunt deer and doves. Nobody machine guns a deer. You know, nobody sprays automatic weapons fire on doves in dove hunting season. And grew up in a family that hunted and you know, had hunting rifles and shotguns and so on. And, you know, there are safety concerns about it, obviously. But you can't massacre somebody with ordinary hunting guns. You really have to have these semi-automatic rifles and also Glocks and similar pistols that have high-capacity cartridges where you just hold down the trigger and it just sprays out round after round after round, bullet after bullet. And there's really no reason why anyone would own such a weapon for recreational purposes unless your idea of recreation is going to a firing range and imagining that you're mowing people down like Arnold Schwarzenegger in a movie. To say that the Founding Fathers envisioned individuals having this kind of weapon, I think is particularly unlikely because, remember, one of the things they were trying to do with the federal government was to strengthen the central government against American rebels, like the Whiskey Rebels. That came after the Constitutional Convention. Between the American War of Independence and the adoption of the Federal Constitution in 1787-1788, there was Shays Rebellion in Massachusetts, where a lot of rural people rose up violently, although there weren't that many casualties, there were some, against tax collectors. And this was one of the things that motivated George Washington, who became the presiding officer at the Constitutional Convention, and others to meet to come up with a stronger, more centralized government, which, among other things, could keep a bunch of anti-tax rebels from terrorizing government officials, both state and federal. And then one of his necessary actions as president of the United States was to assemble. George Washington led more soldiers than he actually led in the American War of Independence at any one time, in a show of force, to put down the Whiskey Rebellion, which was an anti-tax rebellion that was stimulated by excise taxes on whiskey to fund the national debt. So I really think if you went back and asked George Washington and Ben Franklin and James Madison if they thought the federal constitution incorporated something that would allow the Whiskey Rebels and the members of Shays' Rebellion to have the most advanced high-tech weapons of war to use against their very own government, they would think that's absurd.
So I think you've very effectively exploded the myth that the Second Amendment defenders who misread our history, believing that armed citizens won our freedom and continue to protect it. We also have modern examples of the notion that you need to have the family machine gun in order to protect your liberty. What's happened, of course, recently with the Arab Spring in Egypt, Tunisia, for example, they're fairly glaring examples of peaceful rebellion against a military. And also, of course, going back a little further, Boris Yeltsin won the freedom for Russia from the communist regime, standing on a tank with peaceful demonstrators, not, you know, picking up a machine gun and going to war against the Red Army.
Yeah, well, let's be clear. The fact that the NRA misuses the example of popular rebellion does not mean that you don't have to have revolutions in some countries. And perhaps if you one day, you know, let's hope it doesn't happen, but, you know, over time, practically anything can happen. If there's a tyranny in the United States, then you may have to have a revolution against that. What we find in modern societies, as I point out, is that the swing vote, as it were, the deciding factor in modern successful revolutions tends to be the professional military. And the people play the role, the ordinary citizens, usually through nonviolent protests, one of the purposes of which is to persuade much or all of the military to break with the regime and to side with the people. So there is a place for citizens, but it's not as citizens spraying people with machine gun fire or engaged in hand-to-hand combat. It's risking their lives, and often they're slaughtered. They're often initially cut down by the forces of a tyrannical regime, but they can risk their lives and limbs in nonviolent Gandhi-like protests until, if the revolution is successful, the military turns against the regime and says, we're not going to gun down our siblings and our parents and our teachers and our neighbors. Now, sometimes that doesn't work. For example, in Iran, it has not worked yet. In Syria, it hasn't worked. It succeeded in Egypt. That was essentially the story of the downfall of communism in Russia and in the Soviet Empire. But given the weapons at the disposal of modern states, even fairly backward states, the idea that some ordinary householder, even if you have, you know, these Bushmaster, you know, military-type weapons, is going to hold out for long against a modern military, I think is just naive. And we don't actually, as I point out in my Salon piece, we don't have any contemporary examples of that. All of the major successful revolutions, it's true of the Orange Revolutions in Eastern Europe, it's true of the revolution against Ferdinand Marcos, it's this combination of the unarmed, peacefully protesting citizenry, and then of the professional military, which sides with the citizens against the regime.
Well, what explains, though, this anti-government paranoia in the United States that leads people to believe that they need the family machine gun to protect our liberties? It's both the alienation that a lot of Americans feel towards their government on the far right with the militia movement and the people that believe in black helicopters and the government wants to put a computer chip in your backside. And then you have on the left, you have all kinds of anti-government theories about the 9/11 conspiracy, etc., where they basically voluntarily, they feel alienation from the very government that they own. And of course, it's led to our pathetic politics where citizens aren't engaged. They've only half the people vote. And we have, we get the government we deserve.
Well, I think you have to distinguish the left and the right. There really is no longer a left-wing terrorist factions of any kind in the United States that's significant. Apart, there are some environmental vandals.
No, but I'm not talking about revolutionary. I'm talking about anti-government paranoia. I don't mean the people acting on it.
No, but that's my point. The point I'm leading to is if anyone had reason to be paranoid about the government, it would be African Americans and Latinos, right? And even Asian Americans, who Japanese Americans put in concentration camps. There are not a whole lot of black, Latino, and Asian militia members accumulating weapons. And in my view, race is at the center of all of this. That is, up until the Civil Rights Revolution, this kind of militia stuff was not a big deal among whites, particularly in the South, because the state government was the militia. The state government was enforcing the South African-type white supremacist apartheid regime. I don't think you can explain the militia movement as though it's different from white supremacy, given the enormous overlaps between the two. And what happened was the white supremacists, once they lost, the governments were no longer, at least the state governments, were no longer protecting white supremacy locally. They decided that the entire government, you know, in the old days it was the federal government was the threat to white supremacy, but the state governments of Texas and Mississippi and Georgia were its allies. But once they lost the state and the local and the county and the city governments, I think that's when this modern militia movement, which is racist to the core, originated. So I don't think it's right simply to say this modern right-wing militia movement is the outgrowth of the old Scots-Irish, you know, frontier spirit of don't tread on me. You didn't have this sort of thing in the 1920s. You didn't have it in the 1950s because they had their friends were in the state house and in the state legislature and the state police. I don't think you can see this except as kind of a toxic consequence of the expiration of white supremacy in the United States. That's not to say that there aren't other violent groups.
Sure.
But most of these anti-government militia movements are deeply, deeply white supremacist.
So, Michael Lind, the president, of course, has just come out and suggested that he's going to really do something about gun violence in this country, and he's put Vice President Biden in charge of an effort to get all the government agencies cooperating, and he's vowing that this is not going to be some study that has a commission and then a few people read the study and then it gathers dust and nothing gets done. He's basically saying he's going to really try and get something done. But already the Republicans in the House, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has basically said no, they're not interested in gun control. And the Republican Party today is essentially controlled by the Tea Party wing, who sound a lot like the Whiskey Rebellion people, and they're driven by a combination of market fundamentalism and religious fundamentalism. So how do you get rid of, what do you do about this kind of toxic brew of market fundamentalism and religious fundamentalism that's captured one of the parties?
Well, I think the thing they all share, again, it's this post-white supremacist a disorientation of non-Hispanic whites who find themselves becoming a minority in their own country. And I think, like, the religious right, the Tea Party right, and the militia right, there's a high degree of overlap there. You cannot legitimately in the United States in 2012 have what they had, for example, in the 1950s, a white citizens council. That's just completely forbidden, overt racism. But I think a lot of the so-called religious right, this gun subculture, it's really the white right. It's really the white supremacist right, or the white minority right, increasingly, in different parts of the country. And I think they just have to be defeated and outmaneuvered. So you go after their pressure points. You're not going to persuade these people. I mean, they're kind of like Afrikaners in modern South Africa. I mean, there's going to be some dwindling remnant. You know, their kids will get more liberal over time, but it's just going to be a while. So what you do is the pressure points are commercial. You outlaw the sale of these weapons to individuals, period. No one should be able to buy and use as a hobby a machine gun. Just forget it. You know, that should be outlawed any more than you can buy a rocket-propelled grenade launcher.
Sure.
You can't.
Well, but Michael...
And then you also use the shame, campaigns of boycotts and shame against these mainstream Wall Street investors and corporations that manufacture this stuff and market it. And I think, frankly, you also have to go after and have a name and shame campaign of this violent splatterpunk pornography. It's essentially murder pornography, these video games. You know, and I think the progressives have to decide, you know, are there any limits to libertarianism? And even if you don't want to use the action of the state to ban this stuff, there's nothing to prevent you from ostracizing this. And I don't, you know, frankly, I don't see why these violent video games should not be banned. I mean, if you had video games in which you were raping dozens of children, one after the other, and that was the game, then I think even most progressives would not object to a ban on that. But you have these video games where you're shooting people's heads off and blowing them up, and their guts are splattering everywhere. Why isn't that as obscene, really, in the most profound sense, as a rape game? I mean, it's a murder game.
Sure. Well, Michael, and just in closing, as we speak, of course, guns are flying off the shelf. I believe yesterday was a record day for the sale of firearms in the United States on the basis that the gun manufacturers are more or less signaling to the gun hoarders in this country that Obama's going to take away your guns. But as I mentioned, his proposals are already dead on arrival as far as the Republican House is concerned. Do you think that any laws will be enacted to, for example, restrict these assault weapons?
Well, you have to have somebody who's counting heads in Congress. There have been a number of some Republicans have said that everything is on the table. Now, the problem with the U.S. constitutional system is there's so many pressure points that even these very tiny ardent minorities can paralyze things. And so we will see. I mean, what's happened in the past is you've had these horrible massacres, and then the NRA and its allies rally, and they kill any reform. And so the United States is the only country where this kind of thing happens routinely. As it was pointed out, around the time of this latest massacre, a deranged individual in China attacked a class of school children with a knife with far less damage. So that I really think the debate has to focus on these weapons. I think it's a mistake to denounce guns as such, because there is a legitimate role, you know, for hunting. Now, the irony is, in most states, including most southern states, you have to take a firearms class before you can get a hunting license. But you don't have to get a license before you actually buy a gun, right? So I think that if you distinguish legitimate hunting from illegitimate machine gun ownership, and you know, the self-defense of the home thing is you know, frankly kind of dubious. As I understand the statistics of it, I'm not an expert, but it's not clear that having guns in the home to protect yourself, that, you know, that's going to be a harder sell. Sure. I think, you know, guns for household defense. But you know, everything should focus on these particular kinds of machine guns. So it's not just gun control in general. It's machine gun control. And I think you will be able to build a consensus for the automatic weapons and the high-capacity cartridges more easily than for just trying to go against all guns of all kinds.
Well, Michael Lind, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. He has an article at Salon.com, Guns Have Never Saved Us. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the findings of a report by an independent panel who investigated the Benghazi incident.
Happiness is a warm gun. Happiness is a warm gun, mama. When I hold you in my arms and I feel my finger on
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nicholas Kralev, who is an author, journalist, and speaker on international affairs, diplomacy, and global travel. A former Financial Times correspondent, he has traveled around the world with four U.S. Secretaries of State, Hillary Clinton, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Madeleine Albright. His latest book is America's Other Army, the U.S. Foreign Service and 21st Century Diplomacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Kralev.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And clearly, for several months now, we've had Fox News with a consistent drumbeat about trying to sort of make this Benghazi incident into a major foreign policy issue. It does look as if this report that came out today fairly squarely knocks down some of their suggestions, saying that the report found no evidence of undue delays in decision-making or denial of support from Washington, and saying that their actions were timely and appropriate, basically refuting the notion that Fox News said that senior-level officials had in some way refused to permit CIA operatives working out of a nearby annex to travel to the main compound to assist in repelling the attack. Do you think that this will put this to rest as a partisan political issue? It's already cost the president's choice as an ex-secretary of state for her job, or a possible job. So what's your sense, Nicholas?
I don't think it'll put to rest any attempt to politicize this even further, because it really has nothing to do with the CIA and other intelligence operatives, because I believe that's in the classified part of the report, which has not been released publicly, obviously. I think what members of Congress on the Republican side will keep harping on, actually, will be the fact that there is clearly a difference between what was said in testimony to Congress a couple of months ago by State Department officials in terms of the how prepared was the mission, the compound in Benghazi for an attack like that, because then it was said that the mission had all measures that were consistent with what was expected, what the threat level was, what the intelligence assessment was. And clearly this report says exactly the opposite, that the security there was grossly inadequate, that many of the people who worked there were relatively inexperienced. There wasn't enough personnel. There was Libyan security personnel that was not sufficiently qualified, not enough in numbers, and in fact, when the worst happened, they just fled the scene.
Well, I think the report does bring that out. And nobody's suggesting, I think, in the report led by veteran diplomat Thomas Pickering and by the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, that they were adequately protected. But my understanding of the actual attack itself, I mean, first of all, it happened on the anniversary of 9/11, and right next door in Egypt, American diplomatic facilities were under siege from mobs. It's hard to believe that nobody could put two and two together and say, well, wait a minute, you know, this is a pretty, you know, post-revolutionary state, Libya, in absolute turmoil, with no central government to speak of, no central military and no coherent police forces, with militias running amok. I mean, let's face it.
Well, actually, the report specifically, and then today, both Tom Pickering and Mike Mullen are actually briefed, and of course, will testify in the Hill tomorrow, but they both said this report was not meant to look into who organized the attack, who was behind it, how they did it. This was a report to find out, was the State Department prepared to handle such an attack? What was done before, as you say, clearly there was an anniversary coming up. Benghazi is not exactly the safest place in Libya or in the region. Did officials in Washington and in Tripoli did all that was necessary? If people in Libya, meaning Americans in Libya, requested certain measures, were they approved or rejected by Washington? And so this was more into looking at the State Department bureaucracy to see is in spite of, we all remember the 1998 attacks in Africa on the two embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. There was a report back then. So were the lessons learned? And it turns out some of the lessons were not learned.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Kraljev. He's an author, journalist, and speaker on international affairs, diplomacy, and global travel. He's a former Financial Times correspondent and has traveled around the world with four U.S. Secretaries of State, Hillary Clinton, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Madeleine Albright. And his latest book is America's Other Army, the U.S. Foreign Service and 21st Century Diplomacy. Well, there have been some heads of role, though, Nicholas, haven't there? Eric Boswell, the Assistant Secretary of State for Diplomatic Security, resigned, along with Charlene Lamb, the Deputy Assistant Secretary responsible for Embassy Security, and Raymond Maxwell, the Deputy Assistant Secretary responsible for the North African region. But there, of course, in the Fox and on the right, people are still saying, you know, Hillary Clinton supposedly has a concussion. Some are suggesting that that's a convenient way for her to slip out of the spotlight and sacrifice these underlings. Do you think that's fair?
I don't have any evidence to believe that the concussion was faked. I don't know that. I suppose every journalist should have a dose of skepticism and sometimes it doesn't hurt to be sarcastic. But in this case, I haven't seen any proof that this was faked or deliberate. Let's face it, she has about a month left in office. I don't know what she could lose in terms of hiding, because I understand that she actually has agreed to testify on the Hill in January. Now, by then, you might imagine that some of the storm would have quieted down, and so the questions that she will get in January may not be as harsh as they could be this week. But in any case, I don't know how, as the Secretary of State of the United States, you fake a concussion. I don't know how you would do that.
Right.
But I think in terms of I wanted to add something to when you were introducing me. You've forget to mention the Washington Times, where actually I was longer than at the Financial Times.
Oh, I see.
I know that it wasn't deliberate, but in any case, I did want to mention that. And I also wanted to say, looking at this.
Well, let's tell our audience, in case they don't know, that the Washington Times is no friend of the Democrats, right? It's a fairly conservative newspaper.
Editorially, yes, but yeah. I was not on the editorial
sure.
side. I was
sure.
writing news, so
right.
I was covering the State Department and writing news. So there is a wall between editorial and the news department and newspapers
sure.
in this country, right?
Right, I believe so.
Right, but what I wanted to say in terms of the sort of the bigger picture here, and everybody's focusing on the phrases inadequate or grossly inadequate and all that. The heads, as you said, three people have resigned from the State Department. When I look at the report and try to step back and think about the big picture of how American diplomacy is being conducted today, it's very clear to me that the United States, after 9/11, perhaps overreached, meaning it opened more missions, diplomatic missions, whether embassies or consulates or other missions. It wanted more people. It sent hundreds, if not thousands of people in some cases to countries. And unfortunately, those people were not properly trained. They were not properly equipped. And in fact, this report says, and I'm not surprised to see that, that some of the people in Benghazi, both security and other personnel in Benghazi, were, first of all, relatively inexperienced. And second, they were there on temporary assignments of 40 days or even less. And so that, to me, that's an issue of, you want to have this very large-scale diplomacy effort around the world, and you send all these people, but you don't train them enough, you don't give them the tools they need to do their job. And by the way, most of those people who come into the Foreign Service today, they've never done anything resembling diplomacy. And so this was, having done my book and this research and studied the Foreign Service for years, I interviewed 600 members of the Foreign Service and visited 52 embassies and consulates around the world. My surprise really was that even in 2012, the State Department, the American Foreign Service, the American Diplomatic Corps, does not have any sort of proper professional development for diplomats. It's just the training is still at a very low level, and meaning not sufficient. And people are surprised when I talk about this around the country and in other countries as well, but there is no proper professional development for American diplomats.
And isn't there this tendency to just move them around so their language skills have to keep learning new languages?
Currently the maximum number of years one can stay in one post is 3 years, which most people think it's not, you know, too little, too short. But, you know, there are posts that are only 2 years, and of course there are posts that are only 1 year. Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Sudan, in other countries actually are 1 year posts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's another issue of, yes, they move around, but the question is, do you have the best or the most effective diplomatic corps whenever the post might be? And clearly, because of the moving, because you jump from one job to another job, sometimes these jobs really have little relation. It's only because they're in the Foreign Service, but you can go from an economic officer position, for example, to a consular position, to a public diplomacy position, which really don't have much in common. And so that's why the training you would think is so important, but unfortunately, in the Foreign Service, they rely so much on improvisation, on osmosis, really, learning by osmosis and figuring things out as they go, very ad hoc. And there are many, many talented and excellent people in the Foreign Service, but the big picture and strategic vision of how American diplomacy should operate, I think everybody I actually interviewed for my book said we could do better than this.
Well, let's just, in the last couple of minutes, Nicholas Kralov, just get back to this report, in the sense, my understanding is that the CIA annex that was nearby, was that they were all dealing with these loose shoulder-launched ground-to-air missiles that they're trying to round up, 10,000 of them on the loose, and that the ambassador himself, Ambassador Stevens, was there on a personal visit to Benghazi, which is one of the reasons why there was very little security. And the report does say, by the way, that he was not, the attackers at the compound were not aware of his presence there, and he died from smoke inhalation. It seems to me that basically this is really a personal tragedy, and the less we say about it, the better. My understanding is from this is that it's just really been blown out of all proportion. What's your final thoughts on that?
When I think about this, you know, the Ambassador Stevens had some idea about the threat level. He, we are told, had expressed certain concerns. But in spite of that, he didn't think that the level was so high, the threat level was so high, the danger was so imminent, that he actually decided to go up to Benghazi. He held a series of meetings that same day on the compound, and because they knew about the situation outside, they didn't want to have any meetings outside the compound. Not that the compound clearly was very secure, but at least that was a measure that they took. But for the life of me, why did he decide to spend the night in that compound, knowing what the security was, knowing what the situation and the threat level were? We will never know the answer to this, unfortunately, because he's not among us anymore. I think at the end of the day, this probably is a personal story, a personal tragedy, and some of those questions we'll never get answers to.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nicholas Kralov.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Kralov, who is an author, journalist, and speaker on international affairs, diplomacy, and global travel. He's a former Financial Times and Washington Times correspondent, and he has traveled around the world with four U.S. Secretaries of State, Hillary Clinton, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Madeleine Albright. And his latest book is America's Other Army, the U.S. Foreign Service and 21st Century Diplomacy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Something to me. An